But it didn't. Writer John Grisham has sold more than 275 million books worldwide. But his first legal thriller was turned down by 28 publishers before one small house finally said yes. Beloved Dr. Seuss had a similar number of rejections. He planned to burn the manuscript of And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street when a chance meeting with a college classmate convinced him to give it one more try. He has sold over 600 million books, and even these many years after his death, he remains the number one best-selling children's author in America. And J.K. Rowling had 12 rejections of her first Harry Potter book before a London publisher gave her a meager advance of £1,500 and did an initial print run of an even more anemic 1,000 copies. Now that the Harry Potter books have sold 450 million copies and been made into movies that earned some $6 billion, it's easy to imagine that the world was simply begging for Harry. But what would have happened if Rowling or her agent had decided that a dozen rejections was enough? It's not just authors and actors who face endless rejections. Theirs are just easier to count. Just about everybody has to decide, consciously or not, how many times they're willing to put themselves on the line. Pushing forward with passion is how you get lucky, but it's also how you get disappointed. Teenagers assiduously court an attitude of being cool as a way of proving that they don't really care what happens. If you're too cool for school, you don't have to worry about getting A's. If you're too cool for the prom, you don't have to care about getting invited. What works to protect a teenage ego backfires for anyone seeking more profound success in life. You get lucky when you admit what you want and go after it. But there's a flip side to consider. Maybe your novel was turned down 28 times because it just wasn't very good. Luck, as we've said, occurs at the intersection of chance, talent, and hard work. And while talent involves traits like recognizing opportunities and having the right networks, it also includes talent. How do you know when the likelihood of persistence leading to luck has, at best, diminishing returns? Sometimes you get lucky by quitting at the right time. Mathematicians and economists have analyzed the question of optimal stopping using such elaborate equations that when I looked at them online, I didn't even recognize some of the symbols. I showed the equations to Barnaby, who offered a more down-to-earth view. A simple method is just to look at how close you've come to your goal, he said. If you're trying to be an actor and get a lot of callbacks but no parts, then keep going. You're close, and the persistence may bring luck. But if you always get polite rejections in the first round, it may be time to look for other opportunities. On my next trip to Los Angeles, I drove over to the very cool offices of movie producer Doug Wick. A red industrial staircase outside led to a lobby with a wooden planked reception desk. Two handsome guys in their early 20s, both with perfect three-day stubble, welcomed me and said Doug was running a little late, de rigueur in Hollywood. While waiting for him, I went into a bathroom that was the size of a small apartment and had a gorgeous kimono encased in plexiglass filling one wall. Doug later told me it had been a gift from Steven Spielberg, his co-producer on the movie Memoirs of a Geisha. When he finally arrived, Doug was gracious and warm and took me to his spacious, light-filled office. Movie posters in the hallways chronicled his successful career, from the 1988 hit Working Girl to the recent sci-fi favorite Divergent. He had wanted to be a producer for as long as he could remember, and told me that while in college, he had been a teaching assistant, TA, in a film course. One of the students in the class was related to the great film director, Alan Pakula. She introduced me to Alan, who gave me a job, and that began my career. So I guess I was incredibly lucky, Doug said. Then with a smile, he added, though it's also fair to say that I was a very good TA. Doug's passion for producing helped him land a deal with a studio. He came up with the idea for Working Girl and pursued it for 2 years, but nobody was interested. His deal was about to run out, and I could feel the building people checking out my space for the next occupant, he said. But having heard that a no in Hollywood is just a postponed yes, he kept scrambling and sweating and finally got the movie script to famed director Mike Nichols. Nichols liked it enough to go ahead. The movie, with stars Melanie Griffith and Harrison Ford, was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture. "You can't let yourself be beaten down or start reacting to life with fear," Doug told me. "You have to persist with optimism. But it's got to be an informed optimism, or you're just a delusional busboy." To Doug, the secret to looking lucky is to love the work you do and never let your attention waver. Over the years, he has worked with stellar actors, including Brad Pitt, Leonardo DiCaprio, Nicole Kidman, Russell Crowe, Sigourney Weaver, Will Ferrell. The list goes on and on. He gave Angelina Jolie her breakthrough role in Girl Interrupted. She won an Oscar and a Golden Globe when she was still early in her career. Thinking about Cassie, the young would-be actress I had met on my last trip to L.A., I asked Doug what might have happened if he had cast a different actress. Would she have been the one to end up Angelina famous? He shook his head. There was only ever Angelina to play that role, because few people have her power and wit and presence on screen, he said. But that magic is only the first step to a brilliant career. You have to keep caring and focusing. Doug learned about what really makes luck the first time he met Jack Nicholson. "I went to his house, figuring I was the smart young guy and would easily manage the old fogey. But as we talked, I realized he was three chess moves ahead of everyone else. And I had that idiot moment where I thought, of course." Nicholson might grin wickedly on camera or play the tipsy Lothario, but to prevail and stay on top in a tough business, you have to be perceptive and attentive to every detail. Recently, some movie studios have turned to data-driven algorithms, and the quants who love them, to try to figure out how to make box office magic. The analysis might suggest that beloved actor A tied with hot-handed director B equals a Netflix miracle. One company uses what it calls neural networks to analyze scripts with more than 100 different components to determine if the resulting movie will be a box office success. Back in 2004, a guy named Ryan Kavanaugh started Relativity Media on what he called a Monte Carlo model, a risk assessment algorithm borrowed from Wall Street that looked at past performance and churned through tens of thousands of combinations of actors, director, budget, release date, genre, and on to decide what would make a profitable film. It sounded like a great idea, a way to bring some stability to a business where, as screenwriter William Goldman said, nobody knows anything. But the math and regression analysis didn't know all that much either. Relativity had some dramatic ups and downs and filed for bankruptcy in 2015. Doug took a different path, relying on his own conscious study. At one point, he went back over the last 100 years of movies, practically the entire history of the genre, and looked at the top 20 hits of each year. Seeing how different themes cycled back led him to decide to do Gladiator with Russell Crowe. But when he first pitched it to Sony, "An executive there lectured me that Swords and Sandals was dead," he said. Doug was in good company for being rejected. Two studios turned down the original Star Wars before 20th Century Fox made billions of dollars with it. Steven Spielberg's E.T. was snubbed by a studio that chose to make something called Starman instead. Ever heard of it? Me neither. Doug bought the rights to what became the four-movie Divergent series when the first book was an unpublished manuscript by an unknown author. "That was kind of gutsy," I said. "The moment I read it, I realized it had every element on my checklist of what makes a great movie. It was a genre story with a compelling heroine, and the world it created made an inviting destination for the audience. Only an algorithm could have missed it," Doug said with a laugh. As Doug and I discussed all the uncertainties in the movie business, he seemed surprisingly calm. Though he had explanations for the movies he'd made that didn't work out, it wasn't the dollars or the fame that kept him going. "People call Hollywood a stone tit. You can keep suckling and not get a drop. I like that metaphor because it makes me think, If I'm doing this, what am I getting? And I remind myself that the nectar is the pleasure of good work and good collaboration. Love what you are doing, and the luck is there, Doug said. When I saw Barnaby again, I told him about my trip and the questions I still had about Hollywood. Doug Wick was a great guy and clearly a talented producer, but like many successful people, he wondered what role random chance had played in his triumphant career. Any movie involves a few crazy years of getting an idea, developing a script, casting, and finding the right director, he had told me. My percentage in making the right choices keeps getting higher, but it's still only a percentage. I couldn't decide if he was being modest or accurate when he pointed out that getting a breakout performance from a young star, as happened with Russell Crowe in Gladiator, is never fully under your control. As usual, Barnaby took out a piece of paper, and this time he drew a bell curve showing what success looks like in the movie business. Most movies do moderately well. That's the big bell in the middle. And a few are at either end, doing very badly or extremely well, Barnaby said. Doug is right. You can't really change that curve. If you make 100 movies, any 100 movies, you'll end up with roughly the same distribution. But what about those algorithms being tried, I asked. Aren't you more likely to be lucky if, say, you have Matt Damon in your movie? I've interviewed Matt Damon a couple of times, and I think he's thoughtful, smart, and pretty darn terrific. He's also one of the most admired actors of his generation. Hailed for hits like The Martian, The Bourne Identity and its sequels, and Good Will Hunting. But as we talked, Barnaby reminded me of a few others. How about Stuck on You, Eurotrip, and Hereafter? You can't say a movie will be a success just because he's in it, Barnaby said. I'd put Matt Damon in any movie, I said, remaining loyal. And you'd be right, Barnaby said, because he had an interesting theory to propose. On the same sheet of paper, Barnaby made another bell curve to the right of the first one. He explained that you can't necessarily change the existence of the bell curve in movies, or most things in life, but you can make luck by influencing where the whole bell curve sits. As Barnaby explained, Matt Damon movies are also going to fall into a bell curve, but that big cluster in the middle may be more to the positive side than movies without Matt Damon, and the big hits on the tail will be even farther out. You can't guarantee success, but using the right elements, you can at least move the entire curve over, so you have a better chance of being at the positive end, where you want to be. And that's just what Doug Wick had done. With his persistence and passion, he had been able to move the bell curve over and look very lucky. Legend says that luck in the movie business gets made at the corner of Hollywood and Vine. But real luck in Hollywood occurs at a very different corner where tour buses can't go, the intersection of talent, hard work, and random chance. Doug knew that he could control the first two, and that let him shrug off the randomness that he couldn't do anything about. It's common to look at those who have one triumph after another and mutter that some people have all the luck. And it's true. Once you have one success, you're more likely to have another. The casting agent knows your name, your book gets put in the front of the store, or the executive in charge of hiring knows that he can justify bringing you on. Research done recently at the Santa Fe Institute by economist W. Brian Arthur has led to what's known as a theory of increasing returns, which has quickly become a paradigm-changing explanation for breakaway success in high-tech companies. He has shown that a product that is popular has a greater chance to become even more popular. Arthur made his name analyzing market share, and his theory of positive feedbacks is true with colas or computers or Harry Potter. Once you get on the lucky path, more good events follow. A lot of people work hard and don't get what they want. If you want to be one of the people who have all the luck, you need to nurture both persistence and passion. Those are the great luck-making personality traits, and you don't have to be born with them. Urging young people to follow their passions is a regular theme of commencement addresses, but the message leaves a lot of new graduates despondent. They don't yet have a passion, so they wait for the epiphany that will give them one fully formed. But that's just not the way it happens. In her book, Grit, psychologist Angela Duckworth points out that passion for your work is a little bit of discovery followed by a lot of development and then a lifetime of deepening. Those commencement speakers would be better off advising that you explore for a while until you find what you care about. Then nurture your interest and decide that you will stick with your approach. At that point, your persistence has the power to bring cascades of luck tumbling in your direction. Thinking about the power of persistence reminded me of an artist named Mark Ulrichsen I'd met a year earlier at the Tucson Festival of Books. We'd both been invited by one of the sponsors, the Arizona Daily Star, and I was impressed to discover that he had done more than 50 covers for the New Yorker magazine over the years. "That's an incredible number," I said when he mentioned it. "Not nearly as incredible as the number that got turned down," he said with a little laugh. Mark told me that cover artists regularly made and submitted dozens of sketches, and only a small percentage ever got selected. Getting 4 covers in a year was considered a big success. He'd had years with just one. More than once, he had worked all night to get in 3 or 4 ideas for a topical cover, and then simply heard nothing. I'd get pissed for a few days and decide I was going to quit, but then I'd get over it and tell myself to grow up, he said. I know some great illustrators who have stopped submitting because it's just too painful, but all that means is that they never get a cover. Mark told me that the odds were even more brutal for cartoonists who needed serious persistence to get lucky. The magazine's cartoon editor, Bob Mankoff, was the guy who said yes or no every week. So I got in touch with Mankoff, and he generously invited me to visit him in his office in the Freedom Tower in Manhattan. I took the subway down and walked around the memorial for a while before taking the elevator to his high-floor office. Mankoff had the good grace to look exactly the way a cartoonist should. Slim as a rail, with a slightly scruffy beard covering his face and flowing silver hair that curled long past his ears. He would be easy to draw. "Hi, come in, sit down," he said, gesturing to a round conference table piled high with cartoon sketches. He was obviously busy, but also happy to take the time to talk about luck. I told him my theory of luck being at the intersection of chance, talent, and hard work. He nodded, pointing out that his good luck started when he grew up in a family where curiosity, humor, and intellect were all part of the mix. "The home environment is the primordial soup from which personality emerges," he said. His mother was an early believer in finding a passion and pursuing it to create a lucky life. She used to say, "You can be whatever you want, as long as you're happy. You can be a garbage man as long as you're the best one." I told her, "I'm sloppy, so it will be hard to be number one at that." Garbage man was out, but it took him a while to know what he wanted to do. After college, he pursued a PhD in psychology and then wanted to be a stand-up comic. When he decided to veer toward cartooning, he submitted something like 500 cartoons to the New Yorker, all of them rejected. "You must have thicker skin than I do," I said. "I don't know that I could persist that long." "Persistence needs to be focused," Mankoff said thoughtfully. "People get distracted by the personal slight and angry at the person or institution that rejected them. They'll explain why that person is a moron and doesn't recognize great talent. They're not benefiting from their failure. If you're rejected, it's probably for a reason." Mankoff kept trying to understand the reasons and develop his style. The persistence paid off, and what luck, he eventually sold a cartoon to the magazine. Then he sold more and more. For 20 years, he continued submitting batches that would be at least 90% rejected, since only about 1 in 10 cartoons ever works. Persistence eventually starts to look like luck. One of his own cartoons became wildly popular and among the most reprinted in the magazine's history. It shows an executive on the phone saying politely, "No, Thursday's out. How's never? Is never good for you?" As the cartoon editor since 1997, Mankoff doesn't say never, but he's very good at no. He has about 50 regular contributors, and he advises each of them to submit, as he did, about 10 ideas at a time. He gets similarly sized stacks each week from his extensive bench of younger cartoonists, as well as unsolicited ideas from all over the world. What's the chance of even the best cartoonists getting the lucky call? There's space in the magazine each week for 15 or so cartoons. You do the math. As Mankoff was describing these odds to me, he got a phone call from David Remnick, the magazine's editor-in-chief, who wanted to review Bob's choices for that week's issue. Mankoff hung up and looked at me apologetically. "I'm sorry, I was supposed to meet David later, but he has time now. Can you stay here for a few minutes?" "Sure," I said. Mankoff scooped up the sketches he had chosen and left behind on the table dozens and dozens and dozens of cartoons he hadn't selected. "I won't peek," I promised. "Peek away," Mankoff said, walking out. Who could resist? Many were by the famous cartoonists whose distinctive styles were immediately recognizable. Some were funny enough to send to a friend. Others were clever enough to evoke a giggle. A few were beautifully drawn and must have taken a long time to create. As Mankoff had pointed out, it would be very easy for those who were rejected to get angry at him or complain about his bad taste. Mankoff came back quickly, Remnick liked his choices, and he tossed the rejects from the table into a wire basket. An assistant came in and whisked them away. Some of the best cartoonists in America were about to find out that this wasn't their lucky week. It occurred to me that when you know the very best case is that 90% of what you do will be rejected, you need dogged determination to keep going. Only those with the passion and persistence to submit one more batch would make luck for themselves another week. But when he sat down again, Mankoff had more on his mind than cartoons. In his view, anybody who wanted success had to understand failure. You want to get lucky? Then sit down and put in the effort. But it had struck him that the persistence we were talking about had much bigger ramifications. "The real issue isn't that I became the cartoon editor, but that I'm still alive and here at all," he said. When he was in his mid-40s, he went through a period of abject depression. He told me that he didn't talk much about it, but after his second wife left him, "I went into a mental institution, spent 3 months there with my mind scrambled, and wanted to kill myself. There was nothing, just nothing. But eventually I was able to reconstitute myself and become successful. Some little pilot light of life was still stirring," he said. Talking about that time of despair, Mankoff pointed out that persistence can do a lot more than give luck in a career. It can be the very source of life. "Everybody's rejected in their work, okay? What's the big deal? Your cartoons are rejected. You'll do more, or you'll do something else. But maybe the real inspiration is to know that you can be as far down as I was and still find within yourself the luck in life," he said. Mankoff is now happily remarried and has a grown daughter. His advice to her, he said, is, "Always give it a shot. The thing that holds us back is the fear of failure or finding out that we're mediocre. People stop growing when they find people are better than them. But motivation and perseverance count for a lot. So many people are doing nothing but watching television." To Mankoff, the goal is to turn off the television and have faith in yourself and the opportunities you can create. When I talk to young people, I tell them that the odds of succeeding in a creative field are small, but they're zero if they don't try. So your chance is between zero and small. To get lucky, you need a positive delusion of your chances of success, he said. When I left Mankoff's office, I thought about that pilot light of life that we need to keep burning. Luck doesn't come in a straight line, however well drawn. And it's in the toughest times, when you think you'll never be lucky again, that you need to find the tenacity and courage to persist. Sometimes it gets you a published cartoon, and sometimes it gets you out of a mental hospital. In both instances, you've made yourself luckier than before. I told Barnaby about my conversation with Bob Mankoff and mentioned his insight that it helps to have a positive delusion. "I think that's another way of saying that optimism matters," I said. Barnaby nodded and quickly agreed that a positive attitude, whether delusional or not, was a key to making luck. It seemed like we now had defined at least one triumvirate of traits included in the talent bucket that led to luck: persistence, passion, and optimism. "If optimism is part of luck, we have to talk to Marty," Barnaby said. Our friend Martin Seligman, a chaired professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, is the go-to person for any discussions about optimism and positive attitude. He more or less created the entire field of positive psychology, and the power of his work and the impressive students he has taught and sent into the world, including Angela Duckworth, have turned the focus of much research in psychology from curing the negative to inspiring the positive. How can we make ourselves happier, improve our well-being, and increase our luck? When we called Marty, Barnaby and I have both known him for a long time, he immediately agreed that a positive outlook could be a key to creating luck. And because he has a complicated mind, he took an interesting turn. "Your question about luck made me think of the science fiction novel Ringworld," he said. He explained that in the story, a character named Tila is brought along on a space expedition as the person who would bring the mission luck. She was descended from 6 generations of lucky ancestors and would therefore be lucky herself. In real life, there's no evidence yet of a genetic predisposition to good luck, but Dr. Seligman didn't think it was so far-fetched. You could at least mold a lucky personality type. "If I were looking for a lucky person to take along on my space travel, the number one ingredient that I'd select for would be optimism," Dr. Seligman said. "Optimistic people have the cognitive disposition to take advantage of good events and not get bogged down hugely by bad ones." As with passion and perseverance, optimism can be learned, and it doesn't take 6 generations. Dr. Seligman considers himself among the naturally pessimistic. "Gloom and doom scenarios are constantly running through my head," he said. And that doesn't sit well on the man who is often dubbed the father of positive psychology. So he is constantly seeking a brighter outlook. "Optimism is eminently changeable," he told us. "You get people like me to recognize the self-defeating, pessimistic things they say to themselves. Then you get them to argue against their catastrophic flaws as if it were a person who was a rival for their job or wife." As an example, he darkly pointed out that he was over 70, the best of his career was over, and it was all downhill from here. And then he quickly argued the other side. He had just gotten a research paper accepted by the New England Journal of Medicine. He had attended a very exciting conference, and he had a new book coming out. Optimism connects to luck in part because it encourages you to keep trying. Early in his career, Dr. Seligman did groundbreaking experiments on learned helplessness, showing that when animals are put in negative situations that they can't control, they eventually stop trying to escape. People, too, have a tendency to lie down and whine when they think they are victims of bad luck. What appears like good luck is often the result of a willingness to believe in a positive future. If you don't believe you can create a lucky future for yourself, you don't capitalize on the good things that come across your path, Dr. Seligman told us. Believing that you have some control over what happens fuels trying. If there's a potentially good event for me, am I going to seize the opportunity and follow up, or am I going to be passive? At an academic celebration in his honor many years ago, Dr. Seligman met Sir John Templeton, the financier and philanthropist who had started a foundation to support big thinking and new ideas. He told Dr. Seligman he would like to support his vision and asked what he could do. "I sent him a grant request for $20 million, Dr. Seligman told us with a laugh. I learned later that nobody had ever asked Sir John for that much money. He turned it down, but I think it was very important that I acted on it. His optimistic approach didn't bring an immediate payday, but it led to a relationship that lasted for decades and included many large grants from the John Templeton Foundation to support his work. Barnaby had a top role at the foundation for many years, and he confided later that, ironically, all the grants Marty received probably added up to that $20 million after all. "To the extent that you can imagine the future in a positive way, you capitalize on it," Dr. Seligman told us. "So optimism plus imagination lets you try for the rich scenarios ahead." A few days later, I walked over to the Paramount Hotel in Times Square at 8 a.m. to meet the just-announced nominees for the Tony Awards. Early morning is not usually prime time in Times Square, but the hotel was a hub of activity as the nominees drifted in. Some of them, like Hollywood stars Michelle Williams and Jeff Daniels, were old hands at awards shows, but many looked slightly dazed, reflecting both the early hour for a late-night crowd and the surprise of the recognition. Great theater requires a lot of elements. Brilliant script, pulsating score, stunning set, charismatic star, to mesh in some magical kismet. Nobody is ever quite sure how it happens, and just as in sports, everything occurs in real time in front of an audience. However well you have trained and prepared, there's always the chance of an unexpected twist that leads to sudden triumph or disaster. Luck always seems to be hovering in the wings. But nobody gets lucky in theater without caring enough to put themselves on the line. If passion, persistence, and optimism were key traits for creating luck, I expected to see them on full display here. And I was right. As I spoke to one nominee after another, I realized that the passion in the room was hot enough to ignite a rocket ship. Many had decided early on that they would do anything to be a part of the theater world. Some had left comfy childhood homes to venture to New York and live in a garret in Hell's Kitchen. Many told me how they got turned down repeatedly, but wouldn't give up. All knew what they wanted. With persistence and passion, they made their own luck. One bright-eyed actor bounded into the room with a cheerful smile and an energy that you could feel at 50 feet. Nominated for his role as the humorously thin-skinned King George in the blockbuster musical Hamilton, actor Jonathan Groff plopped down in a chair across from me and immediately described himself as the luckiest guy around. "The first time I saw Hamilton, I loved it so much that I burst into tears," he said. Lynn looked at me and asked, "Are you going to be okay?" Lin-Manuel Miranda, Hamilton's much-heralded creator, had just offered him the role of King George. Groff could hardly believe his luck. Groff's luck hadn't fallen from the sky. It evolved from burning desire. Growing up as the son of a Mennonite and a Methodist in conservative Lancaster, Pennsylvania, he wasn't exactly raised to think of acting as a high calling. But he sang in local productions and knew that he loved the stage. Like many would-be stars, he said goodbye to his hometown after high school and set off on his dream. Coming to New York, he took acting classes and got a job as a waiter at a restaurant called the Chelsea Grill. It was a good choice, since it happened to be a hangout for theater types. A guy at my table one night said, "You must be an actor. Would you like to see the ends of shows and collect money in buckets afterwards?" Groff recalled. The offer wasn't as strange as it may sound, since the guy ran the nonprofit Broadway Cares, which raises money for the sick and needy in the theater community. For a few weeks every year, actors stay on stage after their curtain calls and make a pitch to support the cause. As the audience streams out, volunteers in the lobby hold out collection buckets. Groff was thrilled at the chance to be a bucket boy. He juggled his schedule of acting classes and waiting tables to show up for volunteer bucket duty almost every night. So I was hanging around theaters and getting to know people just at the time that Spring Awakening was coming, said Groff, of the show that was to become a huge hit. They were looking to cast kids in their teens and early 20s, and there I was. Yes, there he was. He got the lead role and scored his first Tony nomination, this was his second, when he had barely reached drinking age. In Groff's energetic telling, the leap from bucket boy to breakout star was random luck. Hang around the theaters, meet some people, and boom, you're a star. But Groff had been putting the pieces in place since he was in fourth grade. He had been so passionate about singing when he was in elementary school that "I recorded the Tony Awards on VHS tape and brought it to school to play for everyone in math class. I couldn't believe people could sing like that. It made me so joyful," he said. His passion would have been as obvious to a guy ordering a steak sandwich at the Chelsea Grill as it was to the casting agent for Spring Awakening. Getting lucky often requires sticking with something long after others would quit. If you love what you do and deeply believe in it, you're less likely to get discouraged. Holding a bucket, even for a good cause, could feel tedious or even demeaning to a lot of people. But if you see it as part of a bigger framework, you'll do it with energy, passion, and perseverance. And that's what might make you lucky. Groff had spent way too long talking with me, and since the publicist was getting anxious, I wished him luck and sent him to other reporters who were waiting. I watched as he hugged a few people and grabbed a bottle of water, and it occurred to me that if luck happens at the intersection of chance, talent, and hard work, he had them all. He was a great example of all the principles Barnaby and I had been discovering. He put himself in a place where good things could happen, which wasn't Lancaster, and looked for every possibility. He knew what he wanted, so when opportunities came, he grabbed them. He had the skills to shine on Broadway, terrific voice and acting chops, winning personality, and adorably curly hair. Not required, but nice. Add to that the hard work he was willing to put in to achieve his goals, and it's not a surprise that he was a return invitee at the Tony Breakfast. He might have liked to focus on the random chance of being a bucket boy, but really, that was the least important element in the whole story. Talking to Jonathan Groff and Bob Mankoff and Leonard Lodino and Marty Seligman had convinced me that any of us can create a lucky personality. Passion, persistence, and optimism don't guarantee luck, but it's pretty hard to be consistently lucky without them. They are essentials to what Mankoff poetically called the pilot light of life. They light the fire that needs to keep burning brightly for luck to emerge. Chapter 8. How many eggs in your basket? And how many baskets? Take many opportunities. Don't try to be a cowboy. Enjoy the moment, but have a backup plan. Failure can be a badge of honor. One morning, Barnaby rushed to our usual Wednesday meeting a few minutes late and full of apologies. Having run a few blocks, he dabbed at his forehead with a white, well-pressed handkerchief and sat down to catch his breath. "Sorry, it's been a busy morning," he said. I glanced at my watch. It was just a few minutes past 9. So far this morning, I'd eaten a yogurt, washed my hair, and walked over to our meeting. Barnaby had been somewhat more productive. He'd had an early breakfast with a billionaire who wanted his advice, discussed philanthropy with a colleague in Berlin, and done yoga with an entrepreneur from Silicon Valley who was in New York for the day. "You do a lot," I said mildly, thinking that maybe I could have taken the time to put some berries in the yogurt. "Well, the Berlin discussion was just a phone call," he said, clarifying. I laughed. "I'm glad to know that even you can't fly back and forth to Germany before 9 a.m. A lot of people I know are busy. It seems the requirement of the age. But Barnaby's activities cover a wider range than most. He'll discuss karma with Deepak Chopra in the morning and innovative financial strategies with hedge fund genius Paul Tudor Jones in the afternoon. "You get lucky by diversifying," Barnaby said. "You never know which opportunity will pay off, so you need to keep a lot going." My dad used to refer to that as having a lot of balls in the air. For some people, it's a great idea. Juggling a lot of balls is exciting. But if you lose concentration, all those balls can come crashing down. When Barnaby left his position as a top executive at the John Templeton Foundation, he had opportunities from many other philanthropies who wanted him to come on board. He turned them down, wanting to explore new areas. It was going to be more of a challenge, but exactly the kind of challenge he had been missing and wanted more of in his life. My career has been like that, too. I've been a magazine editor and a television producer, and I've written books. Sometimes I wondered if I would have been more successful sticking with just one. But I loved the variety, and having many options meant I always had a next step and an exciting possibility ahead. I never thought of it as diversifying. I just liked new adventures. But Barnaby saw having those many baskets, magazines, television, and books, as a smart strategy. You never know exactly what's going to work, and if one thing goes away, you're already attuned to other possibilities, he said. If you want to capture luck, you have to be able to shift your focus fast if you need to. Barnaby pointed out that to be lucky, you want to diversify your life in the same way that experts recommend you diversify your financial investments. Even if you're the kind of irrational person who thinks you can beat the market in picking stocks, you're not going to plunk all your money in just one stock. Or at least you generally shouldn't. Just ask the people who invested in the companies that became the famous flameouts of the dot-com boom, like Webvan and Pets.com. Sure, they looked good early on, but if one of those baskets held all your eggs, you didn't feel very lucky afterward when they got scrambled. A reasonable investment plan would have you put some money in bonds and some in stocks, and maybe a little bit in commodities, and if one portion goes down, another portion probably balances it out. The nice, safe, diversified strategy is also the one that can make you feel lucky when you're able to retire to Palm Springs and sip a Mai Tai cocktail while lounging on your deck. But what about the big, lucky hit that everybody wants? One guy I know boasts often about having bought Microsoft when it first went public in 1986. The $2,000 he invested then is worth about $750,000 today. Nice. So how did he get so lucky? I gave him a quick call to ask. I had done a lot of research into Microsoft, and I had a feeling that Bill Gates... Come on, be honest, I said, interrupting. How many other stocks did you buy that year that I never hear about? There was a long pause. Okay, I guess that's true. You got me, he said with a little laugh. In other words, he didn't get lucky by picking the right stock. He picked a lot of stocks. He just never discusses the dozens of others he bought at about the same time that didn't go anywhere. People do that regularly. Maybe your brother-in-law happens to mention every Thanksgiving how much he's made on the Apple stock that he bought way back when and has split more times than he can count. Next time he brings it up, ask him what else was in that original mix. Perhaps some shares of Pets.com he doesn't mention? If you don't want to ruin the whole dinner, you can point out that making his luck by diversifying was actually a smart strategy. It's the same reason you have a pecan pie and a pumpkin pie and an apple pie on the table. However much you try to predict, you can never really know which will be the best. Yes, this also creates an excuse to take a slice of each. The venture capitalists who put money into companies in the early stages generally figure that they'll get a return on 1 in 10 of them. If 9 bomb, but one turns into a Microsoft or Facebook or Alibaba, everybody looks brilliant. Following that model, diversifying means you're not betting the farm or the retirement fund on a gut feeling or a tip from that same brother-in-law. Rather, you're spreading the risk and setting yourself up for at least 1 or 2 lucky returns. Nassim Nicholas Taleb, the mathematician and author of Fooled by Randomness and The Black Swan, has spent a lot of time thinking about how to set strategies that can make you lucky in what he considers a random world. What he calls black swan events are those that seem to come out of nowhere and can't be predicted, like world wars and stock market crashes and terrorist attacks. Taleb gives the example of a Las Vegas casino that had planned for every contingency on its gambling floor, but was almost destroyed by completely unprecedented events. A star performer was mauled by a tiger, an employee hid important records, and an owner's daughter was kidnapped. Events like these, rare but with an extreme impact, cause disaster for most people who count on the status quo, but can create huge windfalls for others. Taleb's view is that if you want to get lucky from black swans, you should invest in the extremes. Think of it as the barbell school of life, in which you stay away from the middle and load up on things at either end that are extremely safe and extremely risky. So, for example, you might squirrel away 90% of your savings in something like well-protected treasury bonds, and then put the remaining amount, the amount you're willing to lose, in extremely high-risk possibilities, like Bitcoin or oil wells in Alaska. If you like the idea of the big chance, it's a good plan. But most of us would rather be a little more cautious. Betting on black swans is one theoretical way to create luck. But if you're not careful about how much you're willing to risk, you can end up broke or crazed with anxiety long before the black swan appears. So in both finances and life, you can either diversify with a normal, middle-of-the-road approach or go to the extremes that Taleb suggests. but there's not a mathematician or analyst around who would recommend anything other than diversifying in most circumstances. Great, so we're all in agreement. From every rational perspective, having many eggs in your basket, or many different baskets, sets you up to be lucky. You have more opportunities for success. If you break one egg, you still have several others, smooth and shiny and ready to go. But come on now, admit it. That cautious approach, even with the Taleb twist, doesn't inspire much excitement. We live by the American legend that you go big or you go home. We've all watched Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and endless other similar game shows where the more you risk, the luckier you can get. If you really believe in something, you put everything you have into it. Like the Fred Smith story, Barnaby said, when I brought up the problem. Gamble everything you've got and get so lucky that you create a huge company. Exactly. A few years after Fred Smith graduated from Yale, he had the crazy idea for an overnight delivery service. He raised many millions for the company, which he started in 1971. But over the next couple of years, fuel prices started going up and the company's finances went down. On the verge of bankruptcy and millions in debt, he made a last-gasp pitch for financing to the board of General Dynamics and got turned down. Smith had $5,000 left in the bank. Give up? Nope. He flew to Las Vegas and played blackjack all weekend with the last of the company's money. He made $27,000. On Monday morning, the senior vice president of operations was stunned to see the money in the bank. Terrific! It was enough to pay fuel costs for the week. He asked Smith where the money had come from and heard about the big gamble. You mean you took our last $5,000? How could you do that? Asked the senior vice president, stunned. Smith pointed out that it really didn't matter. The $5,000 wouldn't have been enough to keep them aloft for the week, so it made sense to risk it. He'd had the courage to put all his eggs in the blackjack basket and win. Now that's a story. Bet everything you've got and create a company called Federal Express. Shortly after the gambling weekend, Smith raised more money to the tune of $11 million and was able to keep going. A few years later, the company was profitable and it became so successful that Smith is personally worth close to $5 billion. And you have no doubt gotten a FedEx package delivered to your door sometime recently. At the risk of ruining a good story, I think this kind of mythologizing does everybody a disservice. The lesson is supposed to be that if you truly believe in yourself and what you're doing, you should put all your eggs in one basket and go for broke. Nobody mentions that you might truly go broke. But the truth is that Fred Smith didn't make himself lucky with that one weekend of gambling. He had been building the foundations for his company for years. As an undergraduate, he wrote a paper for an economics class about automation and transportation and how you could deliver stuff by small planes. He later joked that he didn't remember his grade, but guessed it was probably his usual C. After he graduated from Yale, he spent 3 years in the Marines, flying in planes, though he wasn't a pilot, and learning military logistics. All that helped when he started what was then Federal Express. By the time of the Las Vegas story, Smith's innovative Federal Express was already flying 8 planes and gaining a lot of attention. The $27,000 might have felt nice that Monday, but what really mattered was the $11 million he pulled in shortly afterward. The notion of gambling it all in Vegas makes an excellent fable, but it clearly wasn't the only option he had for saving his company. Once I started thinking about it, I realized how often we fall prey to the all-in-one-basket mythologizing. My closet is full of Kate Spade pocketbooks and shoes and dresses, and my kitchen has more of her adorable plates and serving pieces than I should admit. And I've always liked the story of how she quit her job as a magazine editor to start the company. Friends and family thought she was crazy. How could she give up that glamorous job at Mademoiselle? Back then, she was Kate Brosnahan, and she teamed with her boyfriend, Andy Spade, to risk it all on making pocketbooks. Kate has talked about how close the company came to closing. but she stuck with it. Not mentioned as often is that Andy, whom she soon married, worked in the company, but also had several high-level jobs in advertising. By my count, that makes for at least two eggs in their basket, the company and Andy's career. The extra egg makes the Kate Spade origins story a little less sexy, but it also helps explain how she got so lucky. You need time to make a big splash in a crowded fashion pool. Having that sideline support helped her keep paddling. Adam Grant, a Wunderkind professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, used to believe in the eggs in one basket mythology for entrepreneurs. He is known for having an open door for advising students, and among those seeking his wisdom a few years ago were four guys getting their MBA who had an idea to sell eyeglasses online. He was happy to talk with them, but when they asked him to invest, he wanted to be sure that they were fully devoted to their idea. So he asked if they had taken internships the previous summer. Well, yes, they had. And were they applying for jobs after graduation? Again, yes. Just in case, a backup plan, because you never know what will happen with a startup. So I obviously declined to invest, Professor Grant said. Successful entrepreneurs wouldn't hedge their bets. They would sleep on the floor and eat pizza, believe in their idea to the ends of the earth, put all their eggs in the startup basket. The company launched in 2010 as Warby Parker and became an almost instant success. It's now valued at more than $1 billion. Professor Grant jokes that after his bad decision, his wife now handles the family investments. I thought to be an entrepreneur, you have to be a risk taker, and you have to be all in. And what I didn't realize at the time was, first of all, successful entrepreneurs are much more likely to play it safe and have backup plans than failed entrepreneurs. And second, all of the time they spent working on other things was giving them the freedom to do something really original, Grant said. Like Kate Spade, the Wharton Four had some backing that allowed them to take their time and make good decisions. They tested 2,000 names before they settled on Warby Parker. However hard they worked on the company, they were also going to classes and thinking about other options, which probably gave them a more expansive view of their own company. As Dave Gilboa, one of the company's co-CEOs, somewhat awkwardly explained a while ago, Warby Parker wasn't the basket that I wanted to put all my eggs into. I happen to have heard the Warby Parker founders give talks a few times recently, and as they tell and retell their story, something curious has started to happen. Those extra eggs in baskets they kept around don't get mentioned anymore. Smart guys, they know what the startup legend is supposed to be. So they focus on how hard they worked and how little they slept, how they zeroed in on unpacking boxes and responding to consumers to the exclusion of schoolwork and paying attention in class. It's all true and very inspiring, but I'm glad Adam Grant is willing to remind us of the other side. You need to focus and take some risks to get lucky, but you don't have to be crazy and exclude everything else. Finding the right balance of eggs in baskets to make yourself lucky isn't always obvious. Back when I was the editor-in-chief of a big national magazine, I had lunch with a glamorous friend who had the same position at another magazine. This wasn't her first experience as an editor-in-chief, and a few years earlier, she had been unceremoniously fired from the top spot at a hugely popular women's magazine. In the merry-go-round of media, that happens regularly, and it certainly wouldn't be a black mark against her. But she had loved that particular job, and losing it stung badly. Now that she was running another magazine, she was wary and determined to keep herself hedged. "Your problem is that you're too involved with your current job," she told me as we nibbled on our Greek salads with extra feta cheese. "I've learned that you have to spend less time thinking about your current job and more time thinking about where you'll be next." Having a backup option wasn't just her proverbial plan B. It seemed to be plans A through Z. Constantly setting herself up for future opportunities, she saw her current job mostly as a stepping stone. She was networking, appearing on television, and even getting a master's degree in an unrelated field that just happened to interest her. If magazines completely collapsed, and that seemed very possible, she had an entirely different way to go. Preparing for her job to end, she had all her eggs well separated into different baskets. She kept two phones and two computers, one each for the office and home, and had all her work contacts on both. I don't have a single personal item in my office except a box in one desk drawer with my makeup and a hairbrush and a few other things, she told me. The day this job ends, I turn in my work phone and computer, and I walk out with my box and never look back. I understood her instinct, but listening to her made me squeamish, too. If diversifying your life too dramatically meant never investing yourself fully in where you were missing out on some present moment fun. My friend's job did end eventually, as did mine, and we've both moved on to other projects that make us happy. But thinking about our positions, it occurred to me that part of luck was enjoying where you were at the moment. If your backup plan felt more important than real life, something was wrong. Barnaby knew a young guy named Alex Oblin, who had left Google a couple of years earlier and launched an interesting company called Liquid Talent. It was essentially a mobile app to connect web developers and designers with the people who might hire them. Let's follow his progress for a while and maybe learn some lessons about luck, Barnaby suggested. We arranged to talk with Alex on a Wednesday, a few weeks away. When the day came, the conversation didn't go exactly the way we had expected. After some cheerful hellos and assurances that he was eager to talk about making luck, Alex hesitated only briefly when Barnaby asked how he was doing. "It's interesting that we're talking today, because I sunsetted the company on Monday," he said. Sunsetted? I had an image of Alex and his team taking an idyllic boat ride into a glowing sunset. I looked at Barnaby for clarification. "He shut it down," Barnaby whispered in surprise. "Oh, so the boat had indeed sailed, but it wasn't idyllic at all." Alex explained that the company had simply run out of financing. He still believed in the concept, but it just wasn't sustainable anymore, so it was time to let go. "It was a tough decision, but I believe in the adage that when one door closes, a window opens," he said, sounding unexpectedly upbeat. Alex didn't need to search for that window, since it was already part of his blueprint. After he left Google, he was excited to start his own company, but he also wanted to be rational. So when he was beginning Liquid Talent, he also became an advisor to a startup launched by a colleague called Liquid Wi-Fi. "You can't have all your eggs in one basket," Alex said, as Barnaby and I exchanged a sideways smirk. "I always knew that if one didn't work, I had an opportunity with the other." The second egg wasn't solely a backup in case the first one broke. It enhanced both of them. Alex was quick to point out that he had thrown himself wholeheartedly into being CEO and that both companies were made more robust by our connections with each other. The interactions between the two meant he had a bigger network and more talent to draw on. But now Alex was additionally pleased about the double role because he had someplace to go the next morning. We all agreed that failure was no longer an embarrassment. It was more a badge of honor. It meant you had experience that would help as you moved on. Barnaby knew of companies in Silicon Valley where failure was so lionized that they threw regular, "Congratulations, you screwed up," parties. To incentivize risk-taking, they celebrated failure. You didn't hang your head after something didn't work. You swaggered on, proud to have tried. 2 days in, Alex wasn't swaggering yet, but he had a good perspective. As Alex saw it, the company failure hadn't come from anything big, but from the little moments that add up. If one or two more people had said yes to financing, he'd still be going strong. Or maybe it was the split with his girlfriend that distracted him and affected his attitude. "Business is about people, so emotion always plays a role," he said. Over the company's 3 years, they'd had big media attention and ran events that brought thousands of people together. If you looked at success as a moment in time, they'd had plenty of it. After we said goodbye to Alex, Barnaby and I hung out to talk a little more. Barnaby was still surprised by the sunsetting. From what he'd seen early on, Alex had done everything right. He'd brought in top talent and planned his moves carefully. Maybe that changed his chance of success from 1 in 100 to 1 in 2, but it still wasn't guaranteed, Barnaby said thoughtfully. "That's why you need the fallback plan. so you can land on your feet no matter what. And the wisdom of Alex's backup plan became very apparent when we followed up with him sometime later. He had immediately moved full-time to the second company, and shortly after that, it was purchased by Verizon for a hefty sum. Alex sounded delighted. They now had plenty of money to go ahead with a plan to put internet